Good evening and welcome behind the news for March 18, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews up for tonight. First, with the Italian political activist and journalist Luciana Castellina, who was in town this past weekend for the Socialist Scholars Conference. I recorded an interview there, and we'll hear about that, the state of government, opposition, official and unofficial, in Italy, her home country. And then at the bottom of the hour, segment with the editor and a contributor to a book called Voices from the Edge, Narratives about the Americans with Disabilities Act, the editor Ruth O'Brien, and one of the contributors, Leonard Kriegel, will be here. Ruth O'Brien will be talking about the general topic, the book in general, and Leonard Kriegel will be talking about his contribution, which is what it's like to get around New York City in a wheelchair. And it's tough enough to get around this town if you have all your limbs working and senses working, but if you've got to move around in a wheelchair, it's quite a challenge. So we'll hear from Leonard Kriegel on that topic. And just a couple an announcement, and then the usual raft of news, economic news headlines. I'm giving a talk in Huntington, Long Island, this coming Sunday evening at 7 o'clock at the Long Island Free Space, which is at the Unitarian Universalist Church on 16 East 8th Street, Huntington Station, New York. For more information about that or directions on how to get there, you can call 516-6. Oops, I'm missing a digit on the phone number, so you can't do that. But you can visit their website at www.lifreespace.org. That's Long Island Free Space, as they say on the website, by the kids, for the kids. That is, again, at 16 East 8th Street, Huntington Station, New York. I'll be talking about the new economy and what it like life is like after the new economy. And the church is somewhere near the exit, the Route 110 North exit on the LIE, the Southern and Northern State Parkways. Again, that's this Sunday evening at 7 p.m. I'll be there holding forth about the new economy and the Bush economy and whatever else comes up at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 16 East 8th Street, Huntington Station, New York. And that web address again, lifreespace.org. And the economic news. It was reported this morning by the Conference Board that their index of leading economic indicators, so named not because of their prominence but because of their alleged capacity to forecast turns in the economy, that index was unchanged in the month of February. But it has been rising slowly over the last several months, so tending towards a somewhat improving economy, but hardly a boom, which has been the story of the last many months. And the major reason for the weakness in last month's reading was that measures of consumer confidence have been trending downwards. Very surprising in what's supposed to be an economic recovery, but it does seem to be the case that people are having increasingly gloomy evaluations of the prospects of the national economy. And along those lines, it was reported yesterday by ABC News and Money Magazine that their weekly tally of consumer attitudes fell for, what is it now, 4 weeks in a row, and is now below the levels that it reached last September, which was kind of a low after a false recovery last summer. So we're seeing very interesting erosion in consumer attitudes, mainly because the job market is refusing to pick up, but also I think the political atmosphere must be contributing something to it. The trouble that George Bush is having in polls lately is both reflected in the consumer confidence numbers, but also maybe driving them as well. Although the labor market does show and continues to show signs of improvement in at least by the measure of the weekly tally of jobless claims, that is the count of people who've lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to claim benefits, that number fell by 6,000 last week to 336,000, which is the lowest we've seen in 3 years. So we're down to pre-recession levels in this measure. And as I've been saying, as this number has been improving for the last 6 or 8 months, it does seem like the pace of layoffs has been slowing, but the pace of hiring has not been picking up. So while fewer people seem to be losing their jobs, it doesn't seem that people are gaining them as rapidly as they would be in a normal economic environment. And as I've said many times before, we're about 8 million jobs below where we would be were this a normal business cycle recovery, and it is anything but normal. The Federal Reserve announced earlier in the week that it was not changing its interest rate policies, leaving them at historically low levels. These are the lowest levels we've seen in 30 or 40 years on some short-term interest rates, and they've made it quite clear that they intend to keep it that way. And the statement released with that decision emphasizes that the job market is not recovering, that is a slightly gloomier turn of phrase than they used in their last meeting in January. So they then saw signs of recovery in the job market this time around. They're saying that they're not seeing too many of those signs. So that means that the Federal Reserve will stay quite easy, but that also their evaluation of the state of the U.S. economy is that it's not thriving. And finally, I said I was going to try to get somebody on to discuss the Argentine economy. Couldn't find someone for this week, but I would say that it was reported this morning that GDP growth, the total value of goods and services produced in Argentina, rose 2.5% the last quarter of last year, or over 10% at an annual rate. So the Argentine economy seems to be recovering from its depression, and a crisis in depression. And one contributor to that seems to be the debt moratorium that the country announced. And they continue not to service their private sector debts. They did cut a deal with the IMF to keep in their good graces, but they are not servicing their private bondholders' debts, and the private bondholders are quite upset about this, but it does seem to be having some positive effect on the Argentine economy. So let's get to the interview I recorded with Luciana Castellina, who was in town for the Socialist Scholars Conference this past weekend. She was one of the founders of Il Manifesto, the Italian daily newspaper, was elected a couple of times to the Italian Parliament and a couple of subsequent times to the European Parliament, and she is deeply involved in journalism and politics in her native Italy. So let's listen to I apologize for the echo, but this was recorded in an empty classroom at Cooper Union last Saturday, so it's not ideal acoustic environment. So now let's listen to Luciana Castellina. You've said that in Italy you have one of the worst governments in the world, one of the worst oppositions in the world, yet one of the greatest popular movements in the world. So let's talk a little bit about each of those. First of all, the Berlusconi government. Just how awful is it?
Well, it is awful because, he does a lot of things which other governments do, but there is something more about him, and it is that he is also personally the owner of a media empire, which gives him a superpower possibility in relation with other governments. Plus, he became so rich and so powerful through illegal acts, and he is on trial for several things. And he's trying to use the parliament and the majority he has in the parliament in order to change the laws on which he would be sentenced. So these trials go on and on and on and on forever, but in the meantime, he's changing the law. So, there are a series of illegal aspects which added with a traditional, let's say, Bush politics makes him the worst government in the world, I would say.
What about the opposition? Tell us, give us the rundown of the cast of characters there.
Well, the opposition is bad because we have been undergoing a process of transformation of all political parties in Italy in the last 10, 15 years. And traditional parties disappeared and new parties came out, but they are still facing a turmoil, I would say. Let's say Berlusconi was so successful because he came out with a totally new party. Although you find in this party people who corrupted people who have belonged to the previous regime, but the party was new, and this is the reason why people loved it. Even the parties in the opposition are totally new. It's still very difficult to. They are moving and have no more vision, have no strategy, have no identity. They tried to get rid of their old identity and they didn't find a new one. And this is always terrible for a political party. So let's take in detail what happened. We had a very big, important Communist Party in Italy, which was a very good Communist Party. I mean, it was anti-Soviet since a very long time, democratic. It was the largest party of the opposition in the country. In Italy, the tradition is that the Socialist Party never counted very much. Let's say that the Italian Communist Party played the role of the social democratic parties in the rest of Europe. Well, this party was dissolved, and since then we always had the attempt of one part of it to go very much to the center, losing influence and credibility on one side. On the other side, we had part of this party who became sectarian and extremist, and in between, a void. What happened with this? The main part of this democratic of the left, they are called, they went in government in 1996, but they were so committed to look like centrist and not like left wing that we had a disastrous government who did all things which people who elected them did not expect. And so it ended up in a disarray. And when we went to the new elections, Berlusconi won. And instead of learning the lesson, this party is trying to go even more to the center, even more to the right. And this leaves a lot of people without any representation. And in the meantime, we had the growing of this social movement, very important. I mean, in the 80s, the new generation were really victims of the single thinking. I mean, there was nobody who would think in a way which was different from have success in the market, earn as much money as you can, and so on. So this is finished. The new generation shifted to the left. Very much. Of course, you know, I mean, when I'm talking the new generations that shifted to the left, it's always like 1968. I mean, it's always part of the generation. But is the part of the generation which has voice and which has a leadership in expressing the views of the generation. And it was a very important commitment of this new generation, new issues, injustice, to fight against the inequality in the world, for peace, and for the third world. And it is very interesting that this new generation really has a new and different political way of thinking. The communist or socialist tradition is not so strong. The different way to contest capitalism, because they do contest capitalism.
But not by name.
But not by name. They would never mention it. We have a very important commitment of Catholic organizations. When I say Pax Christi, Caritas, Boy Scouts, Catholic Boy Scouts, so traditional Catholic organizations who moved to the left very much and who work together with those who would call themselves even communists. They would, although they have no link with the traditional Communist Party. So this is new. It's a strange generation and a strange movement, very influential, very active. It's great part in the Porto Alegre World Social Forum. But I think in Italy, for curious reasons, I mean, it is stronger than anywhere else. I mean, we were able to bring on the 15th of February 3 million people in the streets. And then for the whole year which followed, we had huge demonstration with 1 million people against the war in Iraq. And this is, again, one interesting thing. The movement got in touch with the unions. At the beginning, the unions were suspicious, and then they finally got involved. And
these now, are traditional unions,
the
not...
The traditional union, the CGL. Of course, the metallic workers, which in Italy always had a more open and left-wing position, are more involved than the other categories. So that is the CGL, the Confederation of Labor, which is involved, which is part of the delegations going to Porto Alegre, part of the preparation of the peace demonstration, which is going to take place on the 20th of March. And so this is new, because the movement started committed on the question of inequality at the world level, Latin America, Asia, Africa. And then they discovered inequality in their own country. And now the question of the salary, of the deteriorating condition of the labor, of the working class in Italy, has become a central issue for them.
And, of course, Berlusconi, a key part of his agenda is attack on pensions as well?
Well, attack on pensions, attack on the rights the labor had. Italy was a place where we had a range of very important rights which the unions had conquered in the 60s and 70s. And this is being dismantled day by day. The rights which gave the dignity to the worker, because the workers could not be fired without a good reason, which gave them the strength, you know, not to bow to what the boss wanted. And, I mean, all this range of rights were very easily understood by the young people, because the question of personal dignity, personal independence, freedom is a different way to look at freedom, which is freedom is an important issue. But then they did understand that freedom, real freedom, depended very much from these laws which had ensured the workers with the possibility of being free towards all the pressures of the boss and so on. So this link is interesting and important, but when you go to the question of for whom they should vote, now we have the elections for the European Parliament, and there is at least 1.5 million people, young people, committed, politically active, who don't know for whom to vote. They don't have party
common,
of reference.
This is not just true of Italy, but this movement in many places around the world is very skeptical about parties and very reluctant to engage too heavily with the state, except to say we don't like it. So how does this going to work out? Is this a strength or a weakness or what, do you see?
I think it's a weakness, of course. I think it's a weakness because they are a little bit millenarist, you know. They don't think that, they have a quality. It's not like in 68 where people thought that the movement thought that it could overthrow capitalist system in the next 6 months or in the next 5 years. They don't believe this any longer. But they have a very anti-capitalistic attitude. They try to impose different values, to legitimize different criteria. And this is very important, to start saying, look, if we think that everything has to be produced, when and while it is giving more profit, this will leave a lot of needs unresponded. And so we have to put needs, human needs, give priority to them and not to profit. And this is not the change of the capitalistic system, but it is the legitimation, a cultural legitimation of different criteria. And this is very important. And they do it in a very practical way, picking up the question of water, for instance, which is a big question, and domestically and internationally, or picking up the question of nature and so on. And so they have, I would say, a more cultural influence, which I believe is very, very important. But of course, then, they should be aware that there is a political life which is going on, and they should have an impact also in institutions. And this is the void we will have to fill. When I say we is a generation which believed in political parties, and that gap is not yet filled. They get involved in making new parties, which may be even good. In 68, too many new parties were made, and they were unsuccessful. And the parties which exist are still unable to interpret this new way of making politics.
I'm speaking with the Italian journalist and political activist Luciana Castellina in an interview recorded earlier this week. Well, a lot of the younger people look at parties and the state and see nothing but corruption and bureaucratization and ossification and intellectual and political death. And there's something to this critique. So how do you get around that problem? Is there some kind of new party that you could imagine that would somehow escape that that trap?
Well, let's say that one of the issues which is more at the center of attention of the movement is democracy. How could democracy work differently in order to avoid corruption, bureaucratism, and all that? They are very committed on that. They discuss very much about that. And the example of Brazil, for instance, of participatory budgets in the town and the community, the budget is discussed by the mayor with all citizens, and citizens take part in the definition of the budget. This experience, which they learned in Porto Alegre, is taken back to Italy and implemented at the city level. And they are very much committed on that. They don't want a new party, they don't trust the parties, but they try to democratize the political life through that. And this is quite interesting.
But can this be developed? Can this continue without some kind of party structure?
It will come. I hope so. It will come. But it's not for tomorrow morning. And this is a tragedy. The timing of the movement is too slow for the timing of the crisis which is precipitating. And I'm very frightened of what may happen to Italy, because Berlusconi is not just a traditional right, it's something else, much more dangerous. It's corrupting and changing institutions and fundamental criteria of democracy. I mean, I think democracy is in danger, in the very great danger today, a little bit over all over the world, but in Italy especially. That you have sort of militarization of politics and authoritarian structures which are set up. So this development goes much faster than the movement is ready to cope with. The movement is it's slow. Yeah, they think in terms of decades, and this is a danger. It may arrive too late.
From a distance, it almost seems like some aspects of American politics are being generalized around the world. There's the reduction in the meaning of the parties. Parties don't really stand for much of anything except the continuity of power. And a great deal of skepticism about engaging with the political process on the part of the population. Great demobilization and loss of interest. Is that what is partly happening? We have a businessman like Berlusconi who looks almost like an American character in some ways.
You see, the point is that for Europe, this is new. I mean, what's happening in Italy is also happening in other countries of Europe. It's new because political parties had an enormous influence and importance in Europe until 10 years ago, or even less. People voted, went to the polls at a high, high percentage. It's not the case of the United States. 85%. And what is happening in Europe now and in Italy is precisely a process which is similar to what happened in the United States. Parties were very ideological in Europe. I mean, they really corresponded to a way of thinking, of values, so that the commitment in the party life was total. It's not like here, where the Democratic Party is, in fact, a coalition of all possible different things. So now the parties are, even the left-wing parties, the socialist parties, are trying to become like the Democratic Party in America. So there is an Americanization process which is taking place, which I think is very dangerous.
What's the effect been of the creation of the European Union? Is that can people engage with that at the continental level of power, or are people still thinking in national terms?
Well, no. I mean, Europe is a dimension which is by now important and imposed, and everybody thinks, the left certainly thinks that this is the only level in which you have to solve the problems, that towards globalization, this is an articulation of globalization which is important. Not only. There is a problem, especially for the left, to save the European model, which is different. The European model is a model of in which welfare state is more important, the unions and the labor movement is more important, the state has a role which has been always more important, and so on. I think there is a reason why the Europe is so different. And when they ask me, what is Europe today? What is the difference between Europe and the rest of the West? Because, of course, when you say what is Europe, you mention a lot of things which are typical also of America and of all the West. Freedom, personal and respect for the individuals, and all that. But this is common to the West. So what is specific about Europe? When they ask me, I say gastronomy and the labor movement, which seem to be very different one from the other. But they have a common origin. And to explain this, I go back to the Marx Grundrisse. Marx writes in the Grundrisse that in Europe, capitalism developed while vital institutions were still there. And he says aristocracy, the church, and the rural world. So that capitalism developed in a way that, people kept a distance from capitalism and from the market. It was not easy, and it never happened, to reduce all values and behaviors to the market criteria. This distance was so deeply rooted in the people that it remained in the common sense. So why do we have good gastronomy? Because market criteria would not apply. We have 1,000 kind of cheeses because we will never make a McDonald's cheese. Because, although if it is not good for the market, because of course it would be much better to have one type of cheese which will go all over and produce in a fast way. Instead, we make artisanal cheeses, and you would never get rid of this because of this distance. And what is the labor movement? The labor movement in Europe is a political factor and a moral factor. It's not just the tool to bargain the price of the cost of labor. It had a cultural and ideological influence in the shaping of our society, in the shaping of the state. And this is true for all the branches of the labor movement, communist, socialist, and Christian. So this is a real difference. And the European model is a model who does not identify with the market in the same way as it does in the rest of the West, in America, for instance. And to keep this model is so important. So this is something Europeans feel. We have to preserve this specificity of Europe. And unfortunately, the European Union is deteriorating every day. I mean, this model, which was strong until 10, 15 years ago, is being little by little dismantled, and the culture on which it was based also. So the importance of the new movement is that they have put back in the center of attention this European model.
And that was Luciana Castellina, who is an Italian journalist and political activist, one of the founders of the daily newspaper Il Manifesto about 30 years ago, elected a couple of times to the Italian Parliament and a couple of more times to the European Parliament. And she was in town last weekend for the Socialist College Conference and recorded an interview. Not taped, it's a little mini disc machine. Recorded an interview with her last Sunday afternoon. And let's take a break, listen to this little historical music, musical commentary from the Kinks, and we'll be back with Ruth O'Brien.
1925. There were thousands of people struggling to survive. There was hunger, unemployment, and poverty. To be free, so
That was a bit from the Kinks song from around 1973, Nobody Gives. My name is Doug Henn with the show that's Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and WBAI.org on the internet. And also remember that you can listen to my shows archived at my website at leftbusinessobserver.com, and you will see a link on the front page to the radio archive. Most of the shows since early 2000 and some highlights of earlier shows than that are on the site. So if you are dreadfully bored, that's always something to do. And now we're joined by Ruth O'Brien, who is the editor of a book called Voices from the Edge, Narratives about the Americans with Disabilities Act, just recently published by Oxford University Press. And we'll be joined in a few more minutes by Leonard Kriegel, who is one of the contributors to the collection. He has a piece in it called Beloved Enemy, A Cripple in the Crippled City, which is about his experience living in and getting around New York City in a wheelchair. But let's talk a bit first with Ruth O'Brien about the book. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Doug.
So the Americans with Disabilities Act is, I think, that the right wing and the business class hates that with an intense passion. Although, you know, it doesn't seem that people who bring suits under it do very well either, do they? So tell us, first of all, what's the idea of the book? Why narratives about the ADA?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I discovered when I was doing a research on kind of my bad news book, which was Crippled Justice and the History of Modern Employment Policy Under Disability, I realized that it's not really a left-right issue. Disability isn't, and the ADA wasn't. And I thought that was very interesting. And what that means, though, but the bad news is that the law has all been gutted. I can say that Title I, which is the employment provisions, has been gutted. Title II is now in the process of being gutted, and if it's not going to be gutted, it's going to be a 5-4 decision in June, and this is something everybody needs to be concerned about. And thirdly, Title III, which is the question of whether or not people can get into public accommodations, is really almost non-enforceable except for one little caveat. So in this sense, the ADA is the most powerful social policy that's been enacted, and yet it is a law that has been taken apart by the federal courts.
You say in your introduction or preface or one of those pieces of the introductory apparatus that the designers, the drafters, particularly Hatch and Dole, deliberately made sure that there was no enforcement mechanisms, at least for some portions of it. Tell us how that works and why did they draft this grand sounding and ambitious law while eliminating or making sure there was no way to enforce it?
That's right. It's a bit of a puzzle. I mean, they drafted it, many people think, because it was their own personal experience. Someone like Senator Dole had faced discrimination himself. And so from this point of view, he thought that there should be some notion of anti-discrimination law and that people and persons with disabilities should actually develop some form of civil rights. On the other hand, he didn't want to cost the employers in particular too much effort. So it is the employment provisions, the ones that allow you to have accommodations, that really have been gutted. And this, I think, is more so from the notion of the question of managerial prerogative power. And that is accommodations are unique in that an employee gets to go and ask an employer, that is if they've been hired, to have accommodations. This means that they get to ask the employer for something that they need. And this is what has really been shut down by the federal courts. But to be a little bit fair, they did create a law that did not have a strong enforcement measure. On the other hand, nobody including the disability rights activists that were very involved in the drafting of the legislation, could have possibly anticipated how hostile the federal courts were going to be to this law.
And why is that? The courts responding to the business world, or
that's right,
legal conservatism? What's the cause?
I think it is this idea of control, that accommodations are about control, because most accommodations actually cost very little. I believe the figure is 70% of all accommodations cost less than $100. So why would
accommodations, meaning that the employer has to make some adjustment in the physical arrangement or the structure of the job or something in order to accommodate an employee's disability?
That's precisely right, because an accommodation is essentially not the idea that it's that you need something at the workplace and the employer must provide for that need. But many accommodations are not actual goods, but they are simply rearranging the schedule. If you take medication, that would make it so that you can't get up early. There are many, many different ways of accommodating an individual, and most accommodations cost nothing. So my research has shown that I believe that the hostility stems from the fact that the federal courts do not like to tell employers what to do. And the ADA does precisely that. It tells employers what to do. So it's not an issue of cost. It's actually an issue of managerial control. Should employees have it, or in any way be able to negotiate with employers, or should the employers have it entirely of their own?
Now, I've heard that the success rate on lawsuits brought under at least some provisions of the ADA are lower than those brought by prisoners. So we're talking about a pretty dismal record, aren't we?
It is a very dismal record. For Title I, which again is the employment provisions, it is only 80% of all suits are thrown out of court, cannot be heard by a jury, meaning on the basis of summary judgment. And the 20% that succeed to be heard by a jury are actually 98% of those are losses. So they are in favor of the employers. So this is why it's I can use the word gutted very liberally in terms of the ADA and Title I.
And you discovered through your own personal experience and your own contribution to this volume that the federal government has exempted itself from the ADA.
I did. This is, I guess, my ultimate revenge book, in that I had an experience at the Library of Congress where they wouldn't provide me with an accommodation. We got into a battle over whether or not I should copy with the lid up or the lid down, because I couldn't use my hands and I couldn't photocopy. In any case, it sounds absurd, but the Library of Congress does not have to follow the ADA, so they very rudely told me that I could, you know, take a hike. So that's kind of part of the genesis of this book, as well as I finally got my own creative writing out there through a little bit of anger. I still haven't taken it to the Library of Congress librarian, but I might think about doing that.
Well, there's a copy in their shelves, no doubt. So tell us about the book. I mean, this is not a conventional political or legal tract.
No, it's not. Because, as I was saying earlier, it's not a left-right issue. What I discovered is that really people have to experience disability before they can understand exactly how frustrating it was. At the same time, I was familiar with the civil rights narratives, and these narratives kind of mix law and fiction. So what I decided to do was to separate the two. So half of the book is creative nonfiction and fiction, and written by persons with disabilities, all of whom have very strong track records and being excellent writers. And then the other half of the book is organized, I mean, the entire book is organized around the law, so the three statutes of the law. And so I'll have a couple stories, and then I'll shadow it with my own legal analysis. And that means there are two different ways to read the book. You can read the book just for the stories, because they're just excellent stories that give you the sense of discrimination, many different types of discrimination, and then at the same time, many different types of disabilities on one hand. On the other hand, you can read these stories with my legal analysis and kind of understand how it is that these people's frustrations or the discrimination that they face is actually interpreted in the courts, and what are the legal answers or legal solutions to the problems of the ADA.
And that's the voice of Ruth O'Brien, who's the editor of the book Voices from the Edge, Narratives about the Americans with Disabilities Act, recently published by Oxford University Press. And we have one of the contributors to the volume on the line. That's Leonard Kriegel, whose contribution is called Beloved Enemy, A Cripple in the Crippled City. Welcome to Behind the News, Leonard Kriegel.
Thank you.
So your essay tells a tale of a love-hate relationship with this city. It's certainly hard enough for someone to get around with functioning limbs, but someone in a wheelchair, it's really quite a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a New York is a fascinating city, I mean, in many ways. but it's particularly fascinating, I think, for someone in a wheelchair. I mean, I think about the best way to deal with it is to deal with it the way I speak of it in the piece as a beloved enemy, recognizing the city's remarkable shortcomings where it comes to where it concerns anyone with a disability. Particularly, I'm writing from the vantage point of someone who is in a wheelchair.
And you have some passages in it about the World Trade Center, which looks in many ways like, or looked in many ways like the epitome of the inaccessible, inhuman building, but it was anything but in some ways.
I love the World Trade Center, and I remember reading when it was destroyed. I remember reading, as a matter of fact, I forget if it was in the New Yorker or in the Times, a friend of mine was one of the writers who was asked to comment, and spoke of the towers as arrogant. I thought the towers were bland, and they didn't really, I mean, aesthetically, they left a great deal to be desired. But what was wonderful about the World Trade Center itself as a complex was how accessible it was. It was almost a wheelchair rider's dream. I loved going down there. I loved racing down the promenade in my chair. I loved the Winter Garden, for example, which was also remarkably accessible, particularly after coming to it, after trying to maneuver through the battered streets of this city, where someone in a wheelchair can almost get seasick with the pitch and roll of the streets and the broken sidewalks. The wonderful thing about the Winter Garden was that there was a space to just zip through. And the space wasn't cracked or broken or rutted. It was smooth. The fact that it was marble also helped, of course. But I really loved the World Trade Center, and I loved it because, curiously enough, it struck me as remarkably human, remarkably inviting. I speak of it as inviting me inside the city, which is not really true of the streets of the city. The streets of the city, for someone in a wheelchair, really, in a sense, try to hold you back, try to keep you away, and try to always remind you of you're not being what the city itself wants. On top of that, they are also, of course, quite dangerous. I wonder if I have time to give you just another example.
Sure.
There's also a question of where the aesthetics of others overwhelmed the reality facing someone who was crippled, who was in a wheelchair. I remember some years back there was a passionate argument in the Times about the keeping the Belgian bricks in the old meat market, which has now become quite fashionable. You know, the streets, the cobblestones were made in Belgium, the 19th century Belgium cobblestones, which for some reason or other is considered an aesthetic plus. For someone going in a wheelchair, and I'm not saying that this is reason to get rid of them, but for someone in a wheelchair, cobblestones are the absolutely worst thing you can possibly have. And when I try to write about that, I've had around four or five op-ed pieces published in the Times. When I tried to interest the Times and simply in making that observation and showing, you know, in trying to look at this problem from another point of view, one that's not necessarily aesthetic or architectural, I was totally unsuccessful. It's just not the kind of thing that is considered sexy enough to be interesting.
Well, your essay is also full of tales with of your run-ins with Village Voice vending boxes.
I single out the Voice because that happens to be those cases held copies of the Voice in the curves. I was trying to jump, and they would but you could single out the Voice or some advertisement for some beautician. You know, those boxes usually on the corners, usually chained to lampposts, and almost invariably sloping down into the curb cut that you have to mount when you're in a wheelchair. But I hope I wasn't singling out the Voice as the Voice. I was singling out that happened to be the paper that was in there, and what right. became my particular bête noire.
But the curb cuts themselves are often in dismal shape. This is something that, you know, some like
curb
me never notices.
Curb cuts in this city are an unmitigated disaster. They're criminal, or they're laughable, or perhaps they're both. But they're simply a disaster. I mean, you first of all, they are usually rutted. The law says that, if I remember correctly, the law reads that a curb cut has to be within 1/8 of an inch of the joining of sidewalk to street. There are curb cuts in Chelsea that are literally 3-inch lips that take an extraordinary amount of strength to jump in a wheelchair, and that are just remarkably dangerous. The slope of most of the curb cuts, many of the curb cuts, are incorrect. The fact is that I've called the agency in charge of curb cuts, the Department of Transportation, and tried to get them to repair, let's say, the erosion that you get in front of a curb cut, which is almost inevitable, and have met with absolutely no success. I mean, nobody's in charge, and nobody really cares. I mean, it's typical of a city bureaucracy that whose chief function seems to be its own propagation.
Now, tell us a bit about getting around the city. I mean, you're talking about getting to the World Trade Center. You live in Chelsea. Yeah. That's like a 2-mile distance. The subway is certainly not accessible, except for a couple of elevators.
The few stations where the subways work, the few stations that have elevators, 9 times out of 10, so the elevator isn't working. I remember they finally built an elevator at 34th Street, and I didn't particularly want to ride the subway, but I wanted to go down it and look. I don't think it's functioning yet. It certainly wasn't for a year after it was built. Every time I would go by there was always something wrong with it. I think that New York is a very, very difficult city in that sense. I mean, essentially the laws about sidewalk repair are ignored, and I'm not. This has nothing to do even with. This is true for people who walk in the street. The streets of this city are abysmal. They're simply never enforced. There was a particular corner, the corner of I think it's. They recently took it down because I think the building's being knocked down, or there's a new. I'm not sure which. But I think it was the corner of 22nd Street and 7th Avenue, the northwest corner of 22nd and 7th, had a collapsed sidewalk or a portion of a collapsed sidewalk, and it was that kind of yellow tape, warning tape, was put up around it, and it was there for about 2 years. It was recently removed, although the sidewalk has been repaired. There are sections of the city which are beyond belief. I speak, you know, what I imagine Calcutta is like, although I've never been to Calcutta.
All right, and that's the voice of Leonard Kriegel, who is one of the contributors to the volume Voices from the Edge, Narratives about the Americans with Disabilities Act, edited by Ruth O'Brien. We only have a minute or so left, Ruth O'Brien, but what's the future of the ADA? It has, you know, like we said before, it has some grand promises, but not much in enforcement. Is this going to be chipped away to nothingness?
Well, it looks like June we'll find out another big piece, whether or not it's been chipped, and that is with governmental services. And here is really the Rehnquist agenda of new federalism. And at issue is whether or not the ADA is applicable to a state. And the case at hand is whether or not somebody can get into a courtroom, somebody with a wheelchair. And so what the Tennessee has decided is that, no, they do not provide that. And the question before the court is, can the federal law apply to the state? If it cannot apply to the state, that means that the ADA, in terms of Title II, the governmental provisions, which applies to everything, not just getting into a courtroom, will almost all but be gutted. So this is a case to watch. It's called Lane versus Tennessee, and it's a very big issue of state sovereignty and states' rights. And unfortunately, the ADA, which is not a popular law, may be undermined by this. The court watchers say it will be a 5-4 decision. The question is which way it will go. It might be 5-4 in the direction of in favor of the ADA. If so, it will probably be a narrow rendering.
All right, we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Ruth O'Brien, in the studio, and Leonard Kriegel on the phone. The book, Voices from the Edge, Narratives about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Remember, last week I played an excerpt from Alistair Hewlett's version of the Internationale, and I said that I couldn't find a full version of it. Some listener graciously sent me one, so let's go out with the full song. It's quite a splendid version with his Spanish accent and his Scottish accent, rather, and sharp and interesting tone. Let's listen to Alistair Hewlett, and I'll be back next week. Bye.
Arise, ye workers from your slumbers, arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action, they'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, they soon shall hear the bullets flying, we'll shoot the generals on our own side. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No savior from on high delivers, no faith have we in prince or peer. Our own right hand the chains must shiver, chains of hatred, greed and fear. Ere the thieves will out with their booty and give to all a happier lot, each at the forge must do their duty and will strike while the iron is hot. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. The Internationale unites the human race.
And that was a false exit. This is Doug Henwood. I'm back again. That was Alistair Hewlett's version of the Internationale. But I wanted to allow Ruth O'Brien to make an announcement of an event that we didn't get a chance to announce. So go ahead, Ruth.
Thank you very much, Doug. We're having a reading of Voices from the Edge next week, next Thursday night between 6:30 and 8. And there to moderate the event is Leonard Lopate. And some of the people that will read out of their contributions are John Hockenberry, Stephen Casisto, Akeem Novak, and Leonard Kriegel. That event will be at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York in the Elabash Theater, and we are going to have interpreters there as well. The CUNY Graduate Center is at 34th and 5th, or 365 Fifth Avenue. Thank you so much, Doug.
All right, you're welcome, and thank you, Ruth. And so this really is me signing off now. So stay tuned for the news now until the evening. Till next week. Goodbye.